leg from Drexel University.
Good morning. This is such a nice crowd. Hey, this is such a nice crowd. I'm delighted to see all of you, particularly those of you who are from the East Coast, and that you chose to come in here rather than be outside in nice sunny weather. Last I checked, it was like 39 degrees and rainy in Philadelphia, and you know, getting ready to wreak havoc with the travel. And so I'm just delighted to see so many of you here. What I'm going to be talking about today is this concept of intersectionality. And even though the focus of this symposium is on lesbian and bisexual women's health, I'm also going to be talking about African-American gay men and bisexual women and bisexual men increasingly in my research, whether it's this research or the research that I do with heterosexual African-Americans. I find that I am including both men and women in my research because the histories and lives of black men and women in black communities are so inextricably linked. And so I'm going to be talking about issues relevant to both. So I also have no financial relationships to disclose with regard to this research. And what I want to do is I want to talk briefly about this term intersectionality, because I don't know let me just ask for a show of hands. How many people have sort of heard or read some of the literature on this concept? Okay, oh, that's good. All right. So I want to just give a little bit of a framework of the intersectionality concept. I'm going to highlight just a few of the findings related to this from research that I've done over the years with three different studies with black LGB populations. And then what I want to do is talk about the public health implications of a focus on intersectionality, and then invite your questions and comments about it. All right, so let's begin with this definition. It's a little thick, but basically this notion of intersectionality talks about these sort of social identities as well as inequality based on a variety of different social statuses. We could be talking about race, ethnicity, disability status, sexual orientation, and so forth. But intersectionality perceives these as interdependent and mutually constitutive, rather than these sort of independent, sort of separate concepts. And who really brings this home for me is Sojourner Truth, you know, way back, really eloquently getting to the notion of what intersectionality is. And so even though sort of black feminist scholars have been talking about this concept, certainly in the late 1980s and 1990s. Sojourner Truth was so eloquently pointing this out in her famous speech, where she says, "That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and to have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helps me into carriages or over mud puddles or gives me any best place, and ain't I a woman?" And intersectionality really gets to this notion of these as mutually constitutive, because it's not just that she is a woman and that she's black, but the fact that she's a black woman is in of itself the sort of separate reality. And so that this really sums up the complexities of intersectionality. And of course, in psychology, I'm a frustrated psychologist. And so psychology is always is often sort of late to the game. And so there's a special issue out sort of right off the presses now of the journal Sex Roles, just dedicated to this concept of intersectionality. And I have a piece in there where I'm talking about a lot of the methodological challenges of doing intersectionality research and what it means to do intersectionality research. But the point here is that people who live intersectionality have been writing about it in eloquent ways long before psychologists came on the scene. And so as an example, I wanted to share with you sort of a narrative of the complexity of intersections of race and gender and sexual orientation. This is the fabulous Essex Hemphill, fierce poet. And what he's talking about in this interview is several things. I'll first read it. "I always tell people I can be gay in only a few cities in this country, but I'm black everywhere I go. So for that reason, I think it's simple enough to understand that I'm a black gay man. For me, my race, even at the point of my birth, was more important than my sexuality. That's going to always be the case, at least within my lifetime. And so in my research, this is a theme that I grapple with. On the one hand, really trying to understand how does race and sexual orientation and gender and class, how are they interwoven and how do they intersect? But also finding that it's very difficult to measure, and certainly that people talk about intersectionality in terms of ranking. So some people say it's absolutely integrated and they can't rank them, and then there are people like Hempel who talk about it poignantly in terms of rank. As a counter narrative to this is Theoso Fierce, and one of my heroines of all time, Audre Lorde, talking really beautifully about this concept, and what she writes in this essay on age, race, class, and sex, Women Defining Difference is the rest of the title. I find that I am constantly being encouraged to pluck out some aspect of myself and present this as a meaningful whole, eclipsing and denying the other parts of the self. But this is a destructive and fragmenting way to live. My fullest concentration of energy is available to me only when I integrate all parts of who I am. And so clearly getting at the sort of crux of not being able to separate or rank these identities. And I should say, I really like in my work to really bring in the sort of interdisciplinary perspective from poets and people from other disciplines who really sort of arrive at the same place that we social scientists often get to. So I want to talk about some sort of conceptual I call them conceptual cousins. Minority stress basically is this concept that people who are buffeted by stressful stimuli, such as discrimination and so forth, that they experience minority stress or multiple minority stress because of these sort of stimuli from the environment. In a lot of the African American or Black lesbian literature, there is this concept of the jeopardy approach, either sort of double jeopardy of being Black and women, or triple jeopardy of being Black, woman, and lesbian. Beverly Green at St. John's University, who has been a really prolific researcher and writer of issues related to black lesbians, talks about this sort of triple jeopardy approach quite a bit. However, it was something that I was very much focused on when I was looking at this in the early stages of my career. And I am now sort of on the side of people like Kudrows and Utal, who really critique the jeopardy approach in favor of an intersectionality one, because they argue that these identities are not these sort of orthogonal constructs where you have sort of the Black part over here and you got the sort of women part over here and you got the lesbian part over here, and that, you know, and they are not independent, that they really sort of intersect, and it's really hard to disentangle where one begins and one ends. That one of the problems with the sort of triple jeopardy or multiple jeopardy approaches, implicitly they rank identities. And while, as in the case with the quote from Essex Hemphill that I showed you, some people do talk about that. Certainly in my research that comes up a lot, you know, with people saying I'm a lesbian first or I'm Black first. That one problem is you get into this ranking. What are you first? That this approach ignores that the experience of oppression is absolutely intertwined and it interlocks. And also it ignores contexts that shape the rise and fall of identity dimensions. For example, the experiences of a high-income Black lesbian is likely to be quite different from sort of her working-class counterpart. And so when you just sort of focus on this jeopardy part, it really ignores those contexts. And so in terms of the research, there is just an abundant research in the social sciences that talks about the stressful effects and the adverse impact on health, on psychological and physical health for African Americans, well documented, and a little bit for women, the role of sexism and its adverse impact on women's lives. And then there's also a nice healthy bit of literature and research on the impact of heterosexism for predominantly white samples of, predominantly middle class samples of white samples of lesbian, gay, and bisexuals. And so where my research answers is like, oh, okay, well, that's all very interesting, but what about people for whom all of these intersect? And of course, and you can keep going, right? Because we put disability status on top of this, we put poverty on top of this. You see the complexities. Now, this is what we know. Well, there's a lot we don't know. But what we know is sort of Elon Meyer's work has shown that with, again, predominantly white lesbian gay samples, they have a higher prevalence of mental disorders than heterosexuals. And I think it's really important to note here that in explaining that, Meyer grounds that finding clearly in the prejudice and discrimination that LGBTs face. So it's not just that they have more mental disorders. But then when we sort of hone in on African Americans, we have this sort of minority resilience hypothesis that shows that blacks have a lower prevalence of mental disorders compared to whites. But again, trying to understand, okay, well, what about people for whom all of these different sort of marginalized statuses intersect? The literature is quite scant. Cochrane and Mays are one of the few studies that are really focused in specifically on African American LGBTs, and they did this national study back in 1988. And what they found is that black lesbians in that study reported that they were as distressed as HIV positive black gay men, which is a startling finding, and that both black men and women reported distress levels that were much higher than those previously reported in studies of just blacks as a whole or primarily white gay male studies. So, enter my studies. I have done three different studies over the years. The first is with a sample of black lesbians and bisexual women attending a black lesbian retreat in Southern California. And this study involved quantitative methods as well as qualitative. A second one done with black LGBTs in Washington, D.C., where we included, actually, and a small sample of transgender people with qualitative research. And then my most recent study has been in Philadelphia in the last year or so, or, well, last 2 years, looking at similar concepts, but also the concept of identity construction and maintenance. And I use in my research often qualitative research. I find qualitative research absolutely invaluable for understanding the complexities of this topic. And so what I'm going to present to you is just some findings across the different studies about how people are talking about intersectionality. Now, a little bit about the questions. We ask people the first question is something like, if say somebody dropped in from another planet and asked you to tell them about your life as a, you know, like, what would you say? We also ask people to, you know, how do you identify? And it's really, really tricky designing questions, intersectionality questions, because you find yourself, you know, you're limited in how you ask the questions. The way you ask about the questions is necessarily additive. So, for example, you ask somebody, you know, tell me about your experience as a black person. Tell me about your experience as a gay person. Tell me about your experience as a lesbian. And so it's very tricky. And so it really, the onus is really on the analyst to try and disentangle and understand how people are talking about these concepts. As a whole, the research questions try to find out, okay, how does this experience shape their experiences in terms of the stress they talk about? I'm especially interested in the concept of mundane stress, this sort of notion of this unrelenting daily stress, in contrast to the sort of daily hassles literature, which talks about, you know, the stress you feel about, you know, you miss the bus. But how do people talk about the stress related to race and gender and sexual orientation that's just persistent and with them every day? And also, I really am interested in this concept of resilience, this notion that despite the stress, that people sort of demonstrate this this personality characteristic that really sort of moderates the effect, the negative impact of the stress. And I'm also wanting to understand, like, what does resilience look like? How are people talking? How are black LGBTs talking about it? And Beverly Green, in her research, writing, really sort of posits that, is it possible that black LGBTs develop resilience because of the stress, which is something that I find really compelling. But I'm always interested in really trying to get beyond these solely deficit models and really on trying to understand sort of how we can learn more about people from a sort of strengths-based approach. So here is Maxwell, a 43-year-old gay man, talking about, and it'll become very clear to you, just how he is, he's not just talking about sort of one thing, just about sort of the gay part. He says, I think we're living in an age where, you know, it's so thick. It's hard not to know unless I'm being charged by a white mob or being called a nigger or beat down by the cops because I'm a black man. Yeah, those are extreme forms, but I think there are other extreme forms that upset me. To me, subtle, blatant, it happens all the time. I mean, not every day, not every hour of the day, but I wouldn't know what it would be like to live without that. And when I walk down the street, white women and black women and middle-class looking black women jump out of my way because I don't wear a suit and tie to work. So really, he's getting, this is in response to a question about, you know, what's your life like? And he goes right into sort of talking about race, and he's talking about sort of the institutional discrimination, whether it be by the cops, whether it's by even black women, sort of clutching their bags, crossing the streets. And so really getting this notion of like how this is all intersected with being a gay man. A similar theme is posed by Leslie, a 48-year-old lesbian, and she's talking about really getting to the notion of this sort of mundane stress. She says, because it's every day you get up and you don't know if you will get to work without one of these mad dog police pulling you over and getting into beef and you get arrested, then you lose your job, you don't know if you'll get home at night, you don't know if when you go shopping they'll put security on you and be following you around the store. So this is a really sort of good example of this sort of mundane stuff. She talks about every day you don't know what it's going to be. And this sort of comes up over and over in a lot of my work. Actually, it comes up with, I'm also doing a study, an HIV prevention study with black heterosexual men in Philadelphia. Same thing, constant, this notion of constantly being under siege. This guy, this is Joshua, he says, being a black male is probably one of the hardest things you can do or be in this society. Tim, a 42-year-old bisexual man, talks about, in dealing with the homophobia and dealing with a lot of hypocrisy in the black community vis-a-vis gay people, you know, I personally don't go out in the gay community at large and portray myself as a gay person, for example, speaking in gay lingo, for example, or acting in a way that would bring attention to myself that would form suspicion that I would be a gay person if I'm by myself. So this notion of sort of code switching and the toll that that takes on you when you're having to sort of shift your environment and depending on different context is also another example of this sort of intersectionality related stress. Here is Lance. Well, so much is expected, so many roles that one must play to be a black male. You don't stray like from those boundaries because that we should be a certain way. And even among black male peers, you have to be a certain way. Among black women peers, you have to be a certain way. And if you're not a certain way, you're not going to be accepted. So you really have to accept social pressure. You just have to really to be a black male is to accept social pressure. So what I want to do now is just switch gears a little bit and just sort of give you some glimpses of sort of the resilience. This is Marcus, and Marcus says that he thinks that one of his most positive characteristics is sort of an adaptability. I can be street smart and book smart. Sometimes that's so important. You have to know when to say I ain't got none, and you have to know when to say I don't have any. So that this notion of this adaptability, and maybe that's sort of where the resilience lies in people's abilities to sort of shift in a way that allows them to navigate different waters, to navigate treacherous waters. This is Betty. Betty says that, I think that the label of being a black lesbian is unique. It's unique in the universe, and I feel uniquely gifted to be able to love a woman, to love women. And so this really gets to the heart of that. It's not about being sort of black plus woman plus, you know, but it's this sort of this notion of mutually constitutive, and something about this uniqueness gives a freedom, which is what Leslie articulates in the next quote. What I love about being a black lesbian is the sense of living on the margin and the freedom that comes with it. And this is certainly that Audre Lorde wrote about so eloquently, that when you live on the margins, that you have, there's a whole realm of freedom that you're given. And so, again, wanting to understand better the sense of freedom as it relates to resilience. So what I want to close with is just some different implications. I want to talk about implications for theory, implications for research, and then the applied implications of this work. One is that I think that we need to expand the focus on stress to incorporate an intersectional framework. I think that we get a very limited view of sort of the human experience if we just focus on sort of the stress of, you know, being a woman, or the stress of being black, or the stress of being poor. I think there's so much richness to be learned by expanding our theory to have an intersectional framework. But in doing so, we need to be a little more savvy in terms of whether we're focused, what type of stress we're talking about. Are we asking people about their own experiences of stress, their sort of subjective stress, or this objective notion of stress out there? And I think that our theory, and this is something that Meyer argues, could definitely be enhanced by fine-tuning these concepts. The importance of looking at mental health or health in terms of the macro level experience at the individual level, but also these sort of structural level forces and bringing them together. A lot of our research is focused too much, I think, just solely on individual experiences without understanding the impact of larger structural forces like poverty, incarceration, and we could go down the line. And then, as I said earlier, the importance of a positive or strengths-based approach. In terms of research, it goes without saying that more research is desperately needed. There's so little, and I'm talking quantitative and qualitative as well as mixed method studies on black LGBTs, and so few on black, gay, and bisexual men other than HIV risk-related studies. There really is such a dearth on that population. That I'm very much interested in the relationship between intersectionality, stress, and other health conditions. Rafael Diaz, in his brilliant work on Latino, gay, and bisexual men, he found that men who had experienced, who reported experiencing more racial discrimination, more experiences with financial hardship, and more experiences with homophobia were also reported higher rates of risky sex, unprotected sex. And he theorizes and was able to show empirically in his quantitative work that the mechanism that links those is psychological distress, that those experiences cause a spike in distress, and that men sort of, for lack of a better term, sort of self-medicate in a way that has implications for HIV risk. Also, in some research that we have done, we did an intervention in Philadelphia with HIV-positive women, a predominantly black, low-income sample. And what we found is, and, you know, even though it was a real small, the whole sample was something like 185, and of them, say, maybe 32 reported that they also had female sex partners. And the women who reported that also reported that they were much more likely to have to use drugs. They reported more partners and more risky behaviors. And so, again, wanting to understand, like, okay, well, how is this? I started to think, you know, this concept that people throw around, like, sort of the down low and why black men may be engaging, all of that. Well, you know, do we have a sort of similar phenomenon maybe around among low-income black women who are having sex with women? And what impact does the stress in their life have and portend for HIV risk? So there's a lot more to know. One of my colleagues, Randall Sell at Drexel, also talks about a lot in his work about we need more sexual orientation data so that we have the Healthy People 2010 objectives that are laid out with clear sort of strategies for LGBT populations. But he points out that only 6 of the 12 information systems even collect data on sexual orientation. So we have this sort of well of all of this great data potentially on where we could look at the intersections of all these different populations and subgroups, but it's not collected. And finally, some applied implications are really trying to understand discrimination and stigma as a barrier to care. I was thinking of your work, Lisa, where you talked about why the women in the sample may not be going to the physicians, why lesbian and bi women in your sample may not be going to physicians. I mean, it's probably stigma. And then, of course, we can also put that through a prism of access to care and all of that, but I digress. The training for healthcare and mental health providers about the intersectional impact of stress for not only black LGBTs, but other populations as well. But also, I see great opportunities for advancing, for advocacy, organizing, and community building around these points of intersection. It seems to me that it's just such fertile ground for furthering the well-being of black LGBTs and other groups. Thank you.
and such. And I think that researchers like you and others on the panel have really opened my eyes as a researcher, and one of your implications was to capture sexuality when we're doing these larger scale studies. And so recently we've added items to statewide quantitative studies.
Excellent.
Where we're not only asking for the identity, we're asking their sex partners and such, and a lot of that through my work with Lisa and such, that really pointed to me that this is an at-risk group and you need to be able to capture that information. And I guess my question to you is, we've also struggled in the South in particular in being able to measure this idea of discrimination because of a threshold resilience sort of issue, where if you've always been treated this way, it seems like that's just how you should be treated. Whereas when we do more objective medical record reviews for cancer, for example, we know that African American men are much less likely to receive certain courses of treatment and such. So I guess I'm interested in your qualitative work with this population, how you've been able to sort of measure and capture that from an intersectional perspective.
Well, it's really difficult because when you ask people about their experiences, like you said, there's a way that it's just so normative. You've been dealing with this for forever. And so it's sort of incumbent on the certainly on the interviewer and certainly on the analyst to encoding to try and separate those out. Okay, we're talking about your experience. Tell me what you've experienced, not what other people. And so that's sort of one of the things that we struggled with in this and other research. And so it really is sort of asking the question, but from a lot of different angles. So trying to understand about people's sort of subjective experiences and always steering it back. Okay, we want to know about you. And what is the impact on you? What is your subjective appraisal of it? So it really comes down to the questions. Have I answered your question?
Yeah, that's helpful. I mean, I think that it's going to take a combination of different qualitative and quantitative approaches. And just as you were saying, within a more qualitative framework, how are you going to help peel back the layers of that onion to really get at that, the context of that person's life?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, everything.
I was always like one of the cops going to come and security and all that. I found myself wondering, what does she look like objectively to the world? Is she like more on the bush end of the spectrum or the
femme? Oh, yeah.
Spectrum?
Yeah.
You did discuss the professional versus class, but I think the bush femme spectrum would also be interesting.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that woman was sort of a sort of traditional, sort of feminine-looking woman. But and so it didn't come up in her case, but it did come up with other women who talked about that, articulated that explicitly. That because I'm butch-looking, I am getting it all day because I'm non-traditionally feminine. And so yeah, so that's sort of another layer of complexity that's added here. And so yeah, your point is well taken. It's a good one. Yeah. I think her work is fantastic. I especially like her work about this notion of how people come to embody discrimination and how that is revealed in different disparate patterns of prevalence and incidence of disease. I think she is one of the most sort of innovative thinkers out there in terms of really disentangling these sort of thorny issues. And so, yeah, I've got nothing but praise for her work. I say go ahead and use it. Oof.
It's more objective, right? I mean, it's more external. Did you have this experience?
Well, in my work, and not in this study so much, but in the research that I'm doing with HIV prevention, I'm using, and I've struggled with it, I'm using Klonoff and Landrine's experiences of racial discrimination, because it asks people about what has happened in the past year, and then it also asks about the appraisal of stress. How stressful have these experiences been? But that said, it's not perfect. And so what I'm doing sort of right now is with this other research study, we have qualitative research, and we really are trying to develop items about discrimination based on what comes up in our focus groups, in our interviews, and really trying to ensure that we can develop measures that really speak to the population under study. And so, you know, so there's no, what I'm saying all that to say, there's no one measure that I look at on these and says, oh, that's it. It's far more complex than that.
It seems like, you know, what you're getting at is very similar to comfort and stress, but, and there are some scales that have been used in the Hispanic population. It's not only, what you're saying, it's not only the objective experience or subjective experience, but it's how that translates into stress.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, like you said, the acculturative stress doesn't really sort of, I mean, and it's worked with Latino populations, but it doesn't really sort of work as well with African American populations. And so this, you know, Nancy Krieger has said that this, a lot of this research in terms of social discrimination and health is very much in, still in its infancy. And it's quite true. We're really not where we expect to be with this. Thank you.
Oh, more. There's still more. Okay. So next up, we have Dr. Bianca Wilson and her student Chiamaka Akwu from Cal State Long Beach, and they're going to continue on with this vein.